We are pleased this morning to have as our guest speaker, Harold Boy. He is a retired Unitarian Universalist minister and high school teacher. He is involved, he is from Kalamazoo, Michigan. He is involved in a local church plus two peace groups, the Kalamazoo Nonviolent Opponents of War, known as KNOW, and the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. He also has taught courses for the OSHA Long Life Learning Institute on how to talk about politics and religion, the history of the Republican Party, and the history of Israel and Palestine. He also helps tutor in a literacy program in Kalamazoo. He is married to Julie Mack, a journalist, and has three wonderfully unique grown children, Kevin, Sarah, and Catherine, who are good people. This is his proudest achievement, in his words.
Well, hello, everyone. You all can hear me? Yeah, good. You know, one of the things about that people will tell me after the service they couldn't hear, I say, you know, raise your hand. I mean, it's a little too late at that point. But anyway, it's a pleasure being here. There's an old bromide about how we preachers are supposed to structure our sermons. Maybe you heard of this one. First, we're supposed to make them laugh, then make them cry, and then make them feel holy. And that seems like a good strategy, except it's almost impossible. Beginning with the notion that somehow I'm supposed to tell a joke now, in the beginning, with the idea that the congregation will laugh into the body of the text of my sermon, because laughter does soften things, enlighten things. But we all know that humor can be a dangerous thing, and it's difficult to accomplish, at least on purpose. It's like the story of the old English actor who lay dying in his bed, and these two young fellow actors come to be beside him in his last moments on earth. And the one young actor says to the other, not knowing if the old actor could hear him, this dying must be hard. To which the old actor, in a start, opened his eyes and pushed himself up with all the energy he could muster, in a hoarse whisper said, no, dying is easy. Comedy is hard. As to the crying and feeling holy part, well, I'll get to that later in this sermon, but I'm mindful of what one of my professors told a group of us seminarians about how we ministers are to reach the members of our congregation on any given Sunday. And he said you'd be lucky if you could inspire just one person on any given Sunday. In fact, you'd be lucky if you inspired five peoples in the whole tenure of your ministry. But this was not meant to be a humorous sermon, at least not intentionally, because I'm going to be talking about disturbing things. Partly I decided to do this particular sermon because I sense the American citizens and citizens of the world are caught in a storm of hatred and fear in the political conversations, which is making it difficult for us to solve our almost intractable problems. So I know it's not much fun to talk about these things, and yet I believe it's essential to do. For not to means that we'll never be able to even attempt to solve our problems. As the Chinese curse goes, may you live in interesting times. And that, my friend, truly reflects this moment in our lives. We are living in interesting times. So today I want to talk about hope. I know that hope for many of you, if not most, may not be the best of notions. And certainly I can understand that. Benjamin Franklin said, "He that lives upon hope will die fasting." And Patrick Henry said, "It is natural for men to indulge in the illusion of hope." And I can give you many other such quotes. Truly, if we're talking about hope as wishful thinking for the nearly impossible, if not the impossible, to happen, then we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. This past Friday, I was having a conversation with my friend Roger, whom I've known for almost 50 years now. And we both suffered together through many things, including broken relationships, and in my case, the suicides of my brother and my father, which I'll get to later. We talked about how we've been happy, how happy we were when we were young, and how happy we are now. And we both acknowledged that in our younger days, we both suffered a low-grade depression, which psychologists call anhedonia. But even so, I have had so much fun with Roger, primarily playing contract bridge, you know, in tournaments and so on, but in so many other ways. Nobody can make me laugh like Roger with his droll sense of humor. He's also one of the smartest people I know. And so I asked him what he thought of hope. He said that he didn't give much thought to hope, except that he didn't want to be overwrought by expecting too much from people or life, and that he's living a good enough life right now. He's actually in Grayton Beach, you know, towards Panama City. That's where he is right now. He lives in Maine. And there's certainly wisdom to what he thinks. Indeed, there was a study done at our alma mater, The Ohio State University, where Roger got his PhD in psychology. The study was done by the psychology department about marriages and what makes a happy marriage. And they found a key to what makes a happy marriage. I wonder if you can think of what that would be. What makes a happy marriage? Looking at each other. Well, the key to a happy marriage is low expectations. That's what they discovered. The Buddhists will tell you you should have no expectations at all, but that's another story. Anyway, we heard from Paul what he thinks about love and how important it is. And he said these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Now, I certainly agree the importance of love. However, love, I believe, is one of the most overused and misused words in the English language, second only to the word God. Many use that word thinking it means possessions of people, of our spouses, our children, even our friends. But there's that other idea of love that Paul talks about that does not possess or judge, but moves more towards acceptance. And when it comes to children, this kind of love is essential for them to thrive. Fred Rogers understood that and spent his life communicating that idea to children in his television show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. His every show would be part entertainment, part education, and part therapy, because he would have the children confront very difficult issues. They're difficult even for us, such as death and divorce, even assassinations. He knew that pretending that bad things have not happened with children just makes them more anxious and suspicious. Because while children have a hard time understanding the true meaning and consequences of a tragedy, they do know when there's trouble and when there's unhappiness. If they don't know what's happening that makes him more anxious. And Fred would always tell the children, "I like you the way you are right now," every show. Can you imagine how children would feel if they're feeling afraid or angry or lonely or ashamed when they hear these words from this kind, gentle man? Would not their spirits be lifted? And could they not now enjoy the moments of their lives? So obviously, love is important. As to faith, well, some think of it as being like hope, and I can understand that. But there's a difference, I believe. Faith often refers to systematic beliefs, such as a religion. It can also refer to trust as acting in good faith. But it's also akin to hope in the idea that we have faith that there will be a better tomorrow. But for today, I want to distinguish between the two by looking at their opposites. That is faithlessness and hopelessness. The idea of faithlessness implies a life without guiding principles, or worse, without a moral center. And again, faithfulness is important. But hopelessness makes us think about desperate, lonely, and confused people. It makes me think of my father, Carl, and my brother, Walter. As I have had the experience of the two most important men in my life taking their lives, their own lives, I note here that men are three times more likely to commit suicide than women. And that's primarily because men have a hard time expressing what's inside of them in a real way. Men cannot seem to acknowledge their fear or their hurt or their sadness, and thus they suffer in silence. It brings to mind the image of the canary in the coal mine who gives warning about dangerous gases in the mine, warning to the miners. But how does the canary give the warning? By silence. Because the canary has died. And it's a tricky thing to look to silence as a warning. Today, we're hearing a lot from people who were once powerless and voiceless speaking up. No longer satisfied to be silent in the face of injustice. There are men who are loved but suffer from hopelessness. I think of Robin Williams, for example, who took his own life in the most painful way imaginable, and a man who was greatly admired and greatly loved. He had a reputation of being kind to everyone and being generous with his time to young up-and-coming performers. To use a Yiddish word, he was a mensch. So while love and faith are important, we begin with hope. For without hope, faith and love and everything else good in our lives matters not. As my friend Henry DeVries, a retired Christian Reform minister who also lived in the Netherlands when the Nazis were there as a child, and he served as a missionary with his wife in the Philippines and Guam. But Henry would say, a person can live 40 days without food, 4 days without water, and barely 4 minutes without hope. In the summer of 1975, about a year and a half after Walter's death, I volunteered to work for suicide prevention, working the phones and just talking with desperate, lonely, and confused people, but more so listening intently to them. One of our missions was to determine what we called the lethality of the caller's desire to commit suicide, which meant we were to ask them certain questions. How are you coping with what's been happening in your life? Do you ever feel like just giving up? Are you thinking about dying? And so on. And if we determined the lethality was high enough, we were to call the emergency services. I never really had such a conversation that reached that level of lethality. But I do remember one conversation I had with a woman who was divorced from her physician husband. I think he was a specialist because she lived in a condo in a fancy area of town and she had a goodly amount of alimony. And she would spend her time going to bars and picking up men, going home and never seeing them again. And she would spend the rest of her time in bed. I ascertained that she did not think highly of herself, and she didn't believe that she had the ability to do anything special. In a way, I thought that the alimony was deadly for her because it accentuated her lack of freedom, her powerlessness. We talked for a good long time, and remember, this is 1975, but what I recall is, as we talked, she did acknowledge that she had some interests that could lead to some interesting activities. And also, she had other important people in her life that deserved her attention. I came away from that conversation feeling good because I sensed she found hope. That she found hope. That she could find something meaningful in her life to do, and she could also reconnect with her loved ones. Power is a key concept here. For people who feel depressed, feel powerless. My father worked as a nuclear physicist, and I asked him one time why he became a physicist. And he said, "I want to know what makes the world tick." And I thought to myself, I didn't tell him this, but I thought, well, if you want to know what makes the world tick, you study political science. And that's exactly what I did at Ohio State University, the Ohio State University. By the way, I do digress a lot, the ADD. But that "the" part, that happened when I was there, that they started doing that affectation, you know. When I hear it, I just, Anyway, Ohio State University. Intuitively, I knew for me it was important to study political science because it is about how people use power, how they get people to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do on their own. As a political activist today, I see my mission as to check the power of the powerful when they misuse their power, and also to empower the powerless. In a sense, that's what I'm trying to do with you today, to empower you. People who are depressed feel that they have no power, like my father. They tend to believe their powerlessness is about their inability to control other people or events outside of themselves. But there is the hopeful concept of power, of being able to control our own thoughts and feelings. There's a hope that says we believe we can handle any situation. We may not like it, but we can handle it. There are many ways to find that hope. One is to be aware, to be here and now, to pay attention, to experience the moments fully, like a child who wonders at the beauty of nature, the marvel of animals, and the joy of play. Another is just to be with friends and family, have good conversations, to break bread together. The word companion, by the way, if you look at com, means with, and pan. You know what pan is, Italian? Bread, right. So a companion is someone you break bread with. It's one of the best ways to cement a relationship, is break bread. Another way of overcoming depression is to help another person. It's called helping a little lady across the street. And they have studies that show this, that if you help another person, you will feel better. But the problem is that depressed people are so into their own process that they have a hard time thinking of other people. This idea can apply to more than just an individual, this idea of helping other people. I noticed last word in your covenant was to help people, right? It can apply to a community such as a church. For when a church does a social good, the spirit of the congregation rises. And I actually have here copies that I can give to anybody who's interested of an article. It's from the UUA World magazine, fall 2009, by a man named Michael Durrell. And it's called Reach Out to Become a Public Church. And he has the similar notion about the church and the importance of doing these good works. I don't necessarily agree with everything he says in here, but I think it's something that every Unitarian Universalist church should read and take seriously and study, because I think he has some very profound points to make about us as Unitarian Universalists. So I have them if you want any. I have some copies. Finally, one way of overcoming our despair and hopelessness is to look at those who have suffered greatly, certainly much more than I have, and responded with grace and courage because they did find hope. These are people who are humiliated, oppressed, forced from their homes, even killed because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. They have no power at all to act as normal human beings, but every now and then someone in their community rises up and struggles against injustice. They make a difference simply because they act, and their activism brings hope. Sibel Shattuck is assistant professor of comparative religions at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. And she tells a story about the Lakota Sioux of Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, who opposed the building of the Keystone Pipeline that would move 500,000 barrels of oil a day under the Missouri River, just upstream from their reservation. Now, no doubt many of you, maybe all of you, are aware of the demonstrations that happened to oppose that. Those demonstrations, by the way, were spiritual ceremonies with dancing, drumming, singing, and praying to help the demonstration to keep their strength, their power, to withstand the harsh conditions of extreme cold and the brutality of armed security, and not to give in to fear or anger. But what you probably did not know is that those demonstrations came into being because of the work of young Native people who found the One Mind Youth Movement. Even though the issue of protecting the purity of the water and the land was very important, the young people became activists because they were responding to the horrible conditions on the reservation. It was causing tragedies of so many young people committing suicide. As Sibel describes it, life on reservations is hard, and young people often feel hopeless. Their families struggle with poverty. Parents and relatives have serious drug abuse problems. Many experience so much violence in their homes that they have nowhere safe to go at night, and there's lots of social pressure to drink or use drugs. Psychologists have coined the term post-colonial trauma to explain the suffering that persists from generation to generation within indigenous communities. And so the youth were looking for a way to check the power of their oppressors and to overcome their depression by becoming activists. Again, Sibel tells the story of one of those activists. One of the youth who helped found the One Mind Youth Movement was a survivor of this broken world. Jazlyn Charger and her twin sister had been taken from their alcoholic mother and sent in separate foster homes when they were 13. Jazlyn aged out of the system at 17 and returned home only to find that the sister who once been her closest companion now seemed like a stranger. She became depressed and started using cocaine. She was sleeping in abandoned cars with other homeless kids and only weighed about 80 pounds when her cousin, Joseph White Eyes, went looking for her and insisted she accompany him to the sweat lodge. He told her, "You're killing yourself, and we need you. Don't get high. Let's go to the sweat." He got her off drugs and into their culture, and eventually she moved to Portland, Oregon to get away from the negative social environment. But she came back to the funeral of the girl first to commit suicide that summer and stayed to help the other teens and help found One Mind Youth Movement as a group of young activists. The leaders hoped that the activism would teach the other youth skills to survive threats like bullying and drug abuse. In their eyes, the eyes of the elders, the fight against the pipeline, and the eyes of the young people too, the fight against the pipeline was connected to larger struggles in their society, such as the struggles against alcoholism, suicide, and abuse. This is an amazing story that I wish I could have the time to share more fully in detail with you. But what's truly hopeful for me here is that even though these people live in some of the most oppressive and humiliating conditions, nevertheless, the young people rose up and did something. And frankly, while it would be very good if they could stop that infernal pipeline, the true gift of these young people to their elders and to themselves is hope. A hope that knows that something can be done without knowing how successful one can be. And even though we're living in perilous times now, and it does not seem that they will end anytime soon, we can take hope simply because we are alive, and we are powerful, and we are free. Go in peace, friends.